Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Monday, April 11th, 2005, and we are going to continue our public hearing on House Bill 5073, which is the budget bill for the Department of Water Resources. So we will open the public hearing on House Bill 5073 and call Mr. Ward and the cohorts forward there. And we will continue with our discussion of the budget detail.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Phil Ward with the Department of Water Resources. And I think the first thing we ought to do is perhaps direct your attention to the two documents that you have in hand right now. These were follow-up items from our last visit with you last week. The first, dated April 8th, is a little table that shows, at the chair's request, shows the actual expenses dating back to 2003 that we spent on the Klamath adjudication, what our legislatively adopted budget was for 2003-2005, $603,000, what we're anticipating as our actual ending expenditures for 2003-2005 at $985,000. And again, we haven't closed out the budget, so that's an estimate, though probably a pretty good one at this point in time. And then our final, and then the governor's budget at a little over $1 million. So you can see that the governor's budget attempts to recognize the amount of money we have historically spent on the Klamath Basin adjudication and provide those funds in that actual budget for the agency.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil, in the increase in the AG's expenses from 0305 to 0507, how much of that is increase in the AG's rate per hour, and how many additional hours does that buy us?
Madam Chair, and I may ask Mike to join us here real quickly. There are things you want to add to that, Representative. I think essentially as we're winding down the adjudication now, it's moving much more from the administrative phase into that final codification phase where we take all the results of all these hearings, package them in a legally defensive format, and then deliver them to the county court. As a part of this right now, there's a tremendous emphasis on the hearings that are taking place. And the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Attorney General are deeply involved in that element. So I'm guessing the 728 that reflects both the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Attorney General costs that are reflected in bringing these hearings to completion. Mike, you want to add there?
My comment, I'm the administrator for Administrative Services Division. At this time, we haven't done analysis on this was money in the governor's budget for this, and we haven't looked at rates to see how many actual hours this buys us, so I have to get back to that.
Madam Chair, if it would please the chair, if you could give that material to staff, and then staff will disseminate that to all of us. Be great. Thank you.
I have a question, too. The difference between your budgeted and actual or projected actual expenditures in 0305 is a sizable amount of money, almost $400,000. What are you going to do to manage to that?
Madam Chair, this has been an ongoing issue for the agency. We've, as you can see, clear back to 01. We've been spending more than the budget has allocated there. What the agency has done is it's taken cost-cutting measures to ensure that we had funding to cover the adjudication. Most commonly, this was keeping vacancies open a little longer, sometimes for extended period of time, to help generate savings to cover these monies, because we could see that we were not going to meet the LAB in this area.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. Why didn't you just come to eBoard? I mean, it seemed to me that this would be a fairly reasonable request to come to eBoard saying, look, we just need more money to finish the adjudication here to move to the next level. At least part of that you could have recovered, could you not? Or did you ask and you were turned down?
Madam Chair, Representative, since most of our history here predates me, I don't know the direct answer to that question. And it may be that the agency asked the question and was not encouraged to come forward. I don't know, Paul, if you have any historical recollection. Both Mr. Ahman and I are relatively new to our position, so we don't have some of the history here that we could get otherwise.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe the department came forward asking for any additional funding. I would also point out that the emergency board would really be for unanticipated expenses, and I don't think you could count this as an unanticipated expense. My guess would be that if a request were to come forward, your staff probably would have recommended against it under the assumption that the committee that set the budget knew about these expenses, decided not to fund them, and directed the agency to fund them internally.
Madam Chair and Representative, if I could add, this was really a priority for us this time, though, to have the budget actually reflect the true costs of this program. And so we worked closely with the governor's office to ensure that that was the case, because frankly, we would rather work in very close proximity to those legislative guidelines.
Well, and also, Representative Krupp, this is the fourth time that I've heard this agency's budget in my legislative career, and this is the fourth time that I've heard that this adjudication is almost done.
Ouch, Madam Chair.
Are you making a public note of that, are you?
Well, Madam Chair, I share your pessimistic outlook, because I seem to recall that I also have heard this budget twice, I think, now, and it seems to be the same mantra, yes.
The other piece, Madam Chair, that we did in response to a query from Senator Bates about the 1.7 million hits on our website, we did have, Senator, survey data. The major users of our website, consultants, engineers, and realtors.
Still pretty impressive. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Let's proceed then, Mr. Ward.
Thank you. The next piece of our presentation for you today relates to the Field Services Division, and I'd like to introduce our longest-term administrator here in the agency, Tom Paul, who's head of our Field Services Division.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Paul, Administrator of Field Services Division. We'll start off with a list of some of the major activities within Field Services Division. I'll talk about each one of these as we go through the presentation. As you can see, about two-thirds of the budget for the division is general fund, with about a third being other fund, mainly the Pacific Coast Fishery dollars. There are a few small amount of federal funds also. Some of the major activities there are regulation distribution, well construction, dam safety, hydrographic data collection, measuring stream flow, and collecting water levels from wells. Water right changes or transfers is the main activity under that heading. Voluntary stream flow restoration, that can be in-stream leases, and we'll talk about that. And water supply conservation. Under the regulation and distribution, we do have 20 water masters that are located in field offices throughout the state. One of the water masters is located here in the headquarters, Salem office, but the others are located throughout. We do have four region offices located outside of the Salem office as well. In addition to the water masters, we do have 16.4 locally funded assistant water masters, and those can be mainly county funding is providing that. We do have some assistance also from irrigation districts. The state has a total of about 114,500 miles of streams. If you divide that out by the 20 water masters, that's roughly 5,700 miles per water master, which is quite a lot. It's approximately 392 miles from here to Ontario, so you're looking at several round trips, about seven round trips per water master if they were to drive every mile of streams. Additionally, we have 87,000 water rights. Many of those water rights have multiple owners, so they're over time as land has been divided. There are more, you're dealing with more than one individual. 132,558 points of diversion, that's where water is taken. Those are surface water from streams, lakes, reservoirs. Those are actually the points where the water masters have authority to monitor and to regulate. In addition to the surface water, we have 230,000 wells. The majority of those are going to be what we consider exempt from water rate requirements. There are small uses such as domestics, stock water wells. But we still do have responsibility to check those for well construction. We also do have statutory authority to go regulate those based on data priority. So that is a huge workload potentially when it comes to regulation. Another activity that you see us doing a lot in years like this is the coordination and reservoir management with the core projects here in the Willamette Valley. Representative Krepp, I know you're real interested in core reservoirs, and our staff work with other state agencies and the Corps of Engineers to manage that stored water. We also do that in the road as well as up Willow Creek Reservoir up in Columbia Basin.
And Madam Chair, if I may comment, I do appreciate the Corps and Water Resources working together, especially on the Detroit Lake issue and working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and ODF&W in regards to being proactive in storing water a little bit earlier this year and reducing stream flows considerably below what they were in 2001, which the Fed signed off on. And that so we can avoid the disaster we had up in an important recreation area of the state, Detroit Lake, and many of my constituents up there. They did a great job working well together, and I appreciate it.
Well, I think, too, that the recent rains that we're still having has
very hopeful.
Got a lot of things, a lot of people feeling more positive about what the summer's going to look like water-wise than previous.
More forest fires.
Yes.
Chair?
Representative,
I wasn't here Thursday. Did you get any update Thursday?
We did, actually. Do you have
water?
That slide that you could go back
to? We can
include March, though.
Just through March, it didn't.
Did not include March.
Okay.
Have you got one for
I
March?
I don't have
now?
It handy. Yeah. But we can certainly get that data.
I'd like to know what this last 3 weeks has done for us. Mm-hmm. Since I talked to you, because you and I had a conversation.
Well,
and it appears to be ongoing also.
Yeah.
Yes.
Those of us that are trying to get out there and act like it's spring are getting wet.
Good.
The Detroit Reservoir on Easter weekend rose 23 feet in 24 hours.
Wow.
It rained that hard up there, which is a wonderful thing to see. Hopefully. But it's going to take quite a bit of rain to get it up to where it normally is at this point. But
it must have been a pretty awesome thing to watch.
It was quite a storm, they say.
Man,
24 hours, 23 feet.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I think now we're at the point where I asked a question about your ability to monitor those outside of irrigation districts using water. Some people make some concerns to me about, I mean, you only got a few people. Actually, it's impossible for you to keep track of it all to each state. But in these budgets, do you feel comfortable, especially in the drought? I mean, hopefully we'll get help from Mother Nature, but that you will be able to get out there and police and enforce as much as you would like. And I'd imagine you all count on folks out there, neighbors and stuff, keep an eye on one another. Can you just kind of talk to that to me, for me, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I think it's a I think Mr. Paul will be delighted to make that point. If I can just add before we get there, about a month ago, Representative Krieger, we were nearly 50 feet below where we should be in the Detroit system, which is several hundred thousand acre feet. And as of this morning, we were just 14 feet below what's called rule curve, which is where we should be and gaining in the Willamette system. So we're seeing some definite improvement. We're still, the slide we showed last week does show that we're going to project, or we're projecting greatly reduced stream flows yet in the 60% range, perhaps statewide. But it's a lot better picture. One of the things that I think's good is that we've gotten these rains and soaked up the ground a little bit. We were so dry in terms of our soil moisture, and if it dries up enough that folks can get in the fields, we're going to have a better situation. Mr. Paul, for Representative Schaffler, how are you going to handle all this?
Well, before I go there, in addition to Detroit Reservoir that Phil mentioned, Cottage Grove and Dorena are actually at or above rule curve, so we have had some significant precipitation, at least here in the valley. Madam Chair, Representative, you know, with 20 water masters and the number of 16.4 assistant water masters that are locally funded, that's not a very big workforce to go out and monitor over 100,000 points of diversion. Luckily, the users work very well with us when we notify them of water shortages or the need to regulate. Our voluntary compliance rate is up in the 90% to 95%. If it weren't for that, if we were having to take formal enforcement against all of the water users that we found that were taking excess water or that we needed to regulate, our staff would be tied up in the hearing process. We started regulation about 3 months earlier, before the rains. We were up in the Umatilla Basin regulating March 1st, which we normally don't start until in June. So we are going to be regulating more this year, or we anticipate regulating more individuals this year than we have in the past. Regulation will begin earlier, as we're seeing, and we expect it to last longer into the fall. We are working with counties to get some short-term assistant water masters to assist. There is a training period that we're hopeful to pick up maybe as many as 10 additional assistants. More of our staff time knocking on doors and working through some education, talking to people about water rights and what the limitations on what the needs are. So, you know, if the world was perfect, no, we'd have a whole lot more folks. But we recognize that, you know, with state budget and with local budgets, we have limited resources, and we're trying to do the most that we can with those folks. And we're going to do a lot of regulation. We're going to protect a lot of senior water rights this year.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative, one of the things that you'll note is that the governor's budget does not include any cuts for this function, and that's a very deliberate decision. We feel that field force is extremely important to the long-term health of the resource and the success of the people who economically depend on this this resource, and so we've chosen deliberately not to offer that part of the agency for cuts.
Moving on into well construction, we average, or well construction industry, I guess, averages about 6,000 new wells a year. We have a target of about inspecting about 25% of the new wells that are constructed. In addition to the new wells, we do go out and respond to calls if folks are concerned about existing well construction. And quite often when we go out, if we do find a problem, we will return to the same well two or three times through the process until the repairs are completed. We average in the neighborhood of 1,800 well inspections a year. As I said, that 25% of the 6,000 would be 1,500. So we're about 300 over, and that reflects the return visits as well as inspections of other than new wells.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you choose the wells you're going to inspect, and what kind of problems do you run into with wells?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's random. Our well inspectors, if they go out into one area, they will look at new well construction for that area and grab some well logs. So it will be a number of different well constructors, and that's our goal, is to go out and look at the wells done by many well constructors, not just focusing on one or two constructors. That way we have a sense of the type of construction they do, the quality of work that they do, and from that then we can focus in. If we find misconstruction on new wells, we will tend to pull more well logs from those constructors and take a closer look for a while until the repairs or until the constructor adjusts to meet our well construction standards. This slide shows some of what our well inspectors run into when they go out and inspect. If I can, this is hard to see, but here's the well casing. This is the well construction rig. You can see it's quite old. But here is the well, and this is supposed to be sealed. We found no surface seal, nothing to prohibit the surface water or other contaminants just from going over to the well and flowing down the outside of the well casing into the aquifer. It is much easier to contaminate an aquifer than it is to clean it up. It takes a tremendous amount of work to clean one up. So that's why we focus a lot on new well construction, to get out there and work with the constructors as they're drilling. This well casing, see the white line right there? That's the pipe on the inside of the casing. That casing has a hole through it, and what you're doing, you're looking through the casing and seeing the plastic pipe that connects to the pump. Again, a direct avenue for contamination to enter that valuable groundwater resource. And this one, again, it's a little hard to see. Here's the seal, the well casing again, and you can see the seal. And we went out and dug under it, and it's void. So there was only a small amount of seal material put in to look good on the surface. But when our folks went out, they found that there was no seal, again, just an open annular space. When a well is constructed, a larger hole is drilled in the pipe that's put in. So that really does give a direct conduit for any contaminants.
So when you find things like this, you send some kind of a notification to the driller that they need to come out and correct the situation?
Madam Chair, it depends on the age of the well. If it's an old well, we will work directly with the landowner. If it's new construction, yes, we will contact the well constructor as soon as possible, identify the deficiencies that we think we found, and arrange for a meeting so that our inspector and the well constructor can meet on site and see what the problems are. If it is determined that there is a problem, then we start out immediately seeking voluntary compliance to have that well repaired.
Well, and all three of these look like they're wells that have been on the ground for quite some time. Is that the normal case of affairs, or do you find more of the problems in older wells or in recently drilled wells?
Madam Chair, the one on the left with the well drilling rig right there, I think that one is a new construction. And the one on the right, I don't know, you can see some rust, so it could be older. But we find most of our inspections are on the new wells, and we do find a fair number of those that do need to have some kind of repair. Another one of our activities is the Dam Safety Inspection Program. There are approximately 1,150 reservoirs that meet or exceed the statutory limitations of dams that are 10 feet or more in height and store 9.2 acre feet or more of water. Again, our field staff, water masters and assistant water masters, are the ones doing those inspections. And with the other workload, with the regulation, with stream flow measurement that we'll talk about, we have worked very closely with Technical Services Division to look at the 1,150 plus or minus dams, and we've had to rate those based on hazard. We have assigned three different classes, class one being the highest hazard, and if a class one dam were to fail, it would be a large risk to property as well as life, high potential for loss of life. Class two would be likely property damage, but not necessarily the same risk to life. And then class three, you may see some riparian damage, but it would be remote enough to where it wouldn't be terribly serious if it failed. Our folks are focusing on the class one to make sure that we get out and inspect the highest hazard so that if we do find problems, we can get those corrected.
Are you going to?
Yeah, I'm going to comment on the dam program.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, do you duplicate and overlap with Army Corps when it comes to the inspection program?
Madam Chair, Representative, what I should do is defer to Barry Norris because he'll be coming up, and he is the state engineer, and he knows the cooperation that we do enjoy with both Bureau of Reclamation and the Corps, and he could talk about that.
And the short answer, Madam Chair and Representative, is there's a division of labor. And so, Barry, as he can frame that a little better for you, but there is a conscious division of labor on these issues.
Madam Chair, when Barry comes up, it'd be great if he could give us, I know we didn't ask for it, but maybe a thumbnail sketch on the Fern Ridge Dam and what's the status of that and the repair and so forth.
What percentage of the dams that you inspect have problems?
Madam Chair, it's not uncommon for us to find a minor deficiency in a dam, in dam maintenance, but most of those are very minor.
What would be an example?
Brush on the downstream side of the dam, something that needs to be cleared, maybe some debris in the spillway that needs to be removed. And when our folks go out and find that, they work with the owner of the facility. And the owners are typically really good about making those repairs. Those are pretty minor. Representative mentioned Fern Ridge Reservoir. That would be a leakage problem. Not that we're doing that one, but if we found bulges or slumps or cracks in a dam, that could be some very serious, and we don't find very many that are in that kind of condition. The next program here is the hydrologic data collection, stream flow measuring. We have 157 state-operated, state-owned gauging stations that are located out along streams. Those stations, most of them have continuous recorders in them that are monitoring and recording the stage of the stream, the elevation. And then about once a month, our staff go out and conduct a physical stream flow measurement, either from a bridge or a cableway or wading. And when we do that, we're determining the depth of the water and the velocity and the width. And from that, we can calculate the actual stream flow. We have to make those measurements on about a 4 to 6 week frequency to assure that our stream flow record is accurate. And even at that, the best record we can produce is a plus or minus 5%. In addition, we have 48, at least 48 locally funded stations. A lot of those are up in the Tualatin Basin, Washington County, and several of them are down in the southwest area where we have worked with cooperators and installed stations for their specific purposes, and we do the same kind of work. From that, the cooperators will put money into local budgets or even some other funds to us, but mainly it's with counties, and then the counties hire assistants to help. An example of one of these is our POP 131, which is a limited duration hydrographic technician over in our east region. It is other fund, and we're requesting to continue this. This is not an imposition. Might add that in our LFO 10% reduction package, we have five hydrographic techs that go out and measure stream flow, one in each region. And in the 10% reduction, all five of those would be eliminated. Water right changes. Water right transfers, both permanent and temporary, permit amendments, exchanges, voluntary water right cancellations. And then to help us get through the process, we've also put on, worked with our water rights section to put together training for our certified water rights examiners. Certified water rights examiners prepare a large number of the water right transfer applications that are submitted to us, and putting on the training has really improved the quality of that application. And any time that we spend training and working with the certified water rights examiners has really paid off. This, we're excited about the far right-hand side of this chart. It shows our transfer workload, and you can see it's been hovering between 500 and 700 water right transfer applications that are in process. The 03-05 budget contained two limited duration positions to process water right transfers, and there were fees associated with that. These two positions are fee funded. Again, we have another POP, which is 132, and that is to continue the funding of those two positions. You can see on that far right hand side between 2003 and 2004 the impact of those two positions. We reduced our workload by around 200. During the biennium. As of today, we're sitting at 594, and I think we were at 798. We are continuing to work that down.
So how many people do you have then working on the transfers, including the limited duration positions?
We have the equivalent of about 8 FTE. But what we have done is spread this workload out over our regions as well. So we do have folks that we have redirected out in our region offices who are spending almost full time on transfer processing. It is the total number of people that are working on it is probably in the neighborhood of 12 to 15, if you count everybody that actually touches a transfer.
So, Madam Chair, as you know, this is a true economic development activity, because one of the ways to get water is to move from someplace else. And so we were particularly concerned about the level of backlog here, and that's why you all adopted those limited duration positions and some fee authority to support them last session. So it's our hope to continue those positions and continue to work down this backlog. It's still at pretty high levels.
Well, that was going to be my next question. If the the POP 132 positions do continue, what do you estimate will be that bar graph will look like in 05 and 06?
Madam Chair, I expect that we will reduce the number or the workload by over 100 again this year, or this biennium. We're hoping for another reduction of about 200, but I don't know. Some of the transfers that we're working with are very complicated, complex. People seem to be getting more creative
So would, if I was to reiterate what you said, if we could continue these positions, you would expect in 05 that you would be able to reduce somewhere in the 100 to 200 range, and that would consider also the new applications that were coming in, so we would see that bar graph go down?
Madam Chair, yes. I would expect that our workload 2 years from now would be under 500.
And Tom was talking the life of the biennium, Madam Chair, so not just 05. He was actually talking the life of the 05-07 biennium.
Okay.
So our optimistic view is there is a reduction in 200 in the backlog, conservative 100.
What's a reasonable number to have? I mean, there has to be some amount that are just going to be in the backlog because of the complexity and the amount of time it takes to resolve the issues around them. What is that?
Madam Chair, our experience is that it's around 200 to 250. Right now, we are receiving new applications in the neighborhood of 250 to 350 a year. So that would be under a full year's new filing rate, I guess. But you're right. When we start working on a transfer, there are always going to be questions. We're going to be working with the applicants. We can't just pick it up and then get it out the door within the next 3 months.
But is it reasonable to assume then, if we can continue the staffing levels, that probably not at the end of this biennium, but at the end of next biennium, we could be in a range where we could sustain the activity?
Madam Chair, that's what we're hoping for.
Tom, how long is it, if I come in with a transfer today, how long is it going to take you to get to my transfer?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, when we start processing a transfer, with the backlog that we have, we're trying to focus on some of the older transfers that are in the process. If we did not have that backlog, and where we could just pick up the new filings that are coming in, we are hoping that we could get through the process in 90 to 120 days. The reason it takes that long is because there are some notice requirements, newspaper notice requirements, and some opportunity for protest by others who are watching. So. I'm going to back up quickly once here on Phil. We do have another pop, and it's 137. That is a new program, and it involves a half FTE. There was considerable discussion about adjudications last Thursday. We have about 4,000 groundwater registrations, and those are the groundwater claims for water rights where the water use has started before the Groundwater Act was adopted in 1955. Currently, there is no process to change those groundwater registrations or claims, and that is different. Surface water, there is a process to where they can be changed. We routinely run into entities that have these groundwater registrations, and for one reason or another, they need to change them. The well may have failed, and they need to move to a new location. City of Salem, a couple of years ago, was doing some economic development, and there were some groundwater registration wells in the area that they were changing. And they wanted to move the location of those wells and also change the character of use. And this POC would allow us to accept those applications.
I need to pick it up.
voluntary stream restoration activities, short-term leases, in-stream transfers. The in-stream transfers are also processed under the section that we just talked about, and the allocation of conserved water, which is legalized water spreading, where people can go in with conservation measures, save water, and then a portion of that water that is saved, they get to apply to new uses, retaining the same priorities. Water supply, this is a table showing in-stream lease activity, and you can see from the life of the program, there's been a tremendous increase in workload. We are averaging 30 to 35 days from the time a completed lease comes in until we have a final decision out the door. We are current. There is no backlog in this one. Water supply conservation, efficient water use. We work with municipalities, other water purveyors, and irrigation districts on water management plans, and those plans identify efficiency measures, whether in cities it could be metering, leak detection, audits of major water users. And then they put a plan together. We review the plan and work with them on implementation. Some of the highlights over the last biennium: reduced transfer backlog. We had a pretty good workload in review of municipal and agricultural water management plans, and we've eliminated that workload. We've provided training to the certified water rights examiners, and also, as we discussed earlier, coordinated reservoir management activities. And then going through the policy option packages, 090, in the reduction, we have our final proof survey position, which was located out in the John Day area. That position is eliminated. That was the last survey, field survey position we have. But permit holders do have another option by statute. They can hire certified water rights examiners, and additionally, the statute provides that they can continue using water under the permit even if the survey is not completed.
So what this cut does, Madam Chair, is it moves the burden of preparing this documentation, final proof documentation, to the permittee from the state.
Hydrographic Tech under POP 131, that's the one we discussed earlier, that's located in our east region in Baker City. It is a limited duration other fund, and it's a continuation of an existing position. POP 132 proposes to continue the two limited duration positions that are processing water right transfers. POP 133 continues a limited duration for processing water management plans, leases, allocations of conserved water. That was also a new position last biennium, fee-based, other fund, and it is existing. POP 134 continues the limited duration assistant water master position in our south central region in Bend. That one, again, is a continuation, other fund coming from local funds, where the local entity elected to forward that money to us, so we do the hiring. And then the one we just mentioned, POP 137, groundwater registration, and it's a halftime other fund position.
So, Madam Chair, that concludes Mr. Paul's presentation. If you have no further questions, we'll go to Barry Norris.
Let's go. You want to talk about that?
Whatever.
Oh, let's go ahead. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Barry Norris. I'm the Administrative Technical Services Division. We have 38 employees in the Technical Services Division and about a little over $8.5 million budgeted The Technical Services Division is broken out into five program areas: hydrographics, well construction compliance, groundwater hydrology, information services, and dam safety. If you'd like, I'll address the dam safety when we get to that program area, that the questions that were brought up.
And hopefully Representative Krupp will be back by then. He's just testifying on some bills.
Okay. First program area, hydrographics. We, as Tom Paul mentioned, we operate a number of gauging stations around the state. We also do a number of miscellaneous measurement sites where we just take measurements and receive a lot of data on stream flow statewide. Hydrographics section receives that data and manages, does data management, processing those records, a full year's of record into what we call mean daily flows, or an average flow for each day of the year. And then we make that information available for all kinds of things, from flood frequency analysis to design of bridges and dams and roadways, ditches, and so on. So we process the data out there on the streams and rivers into a format that can be used for design. We also do a number of surface water studies and analysis in that section. As an example, the one on the left is a natural flow estimate for streams in the Klamath Basin. We also have done a water availability analysis statewide, and that's the middle map of the state for the month of August, where we assess water, natural flow, and then natural flow minus consumptive use on an 80% and a 50% exceedance basis. So that's an ongoing project. We're constantly updating that. And then various forms of public assistance. This is an example on the right of a brochure that we put together in the hydrographic section for aquifer storage and recovery, kind of a general assessment of the state. In our well construction program area, we have program authority over the whole program, while we have well inspectors in the various field offices that work with the Salem office. So we have a lead well inspector, a manager, and some other support people in this section. We do well inspections as well as the field. This is an example of a well that we inspected and found bentonite bags placed in the annular space around the well casing. I think the intent of it, this was recently under construction actually, and the intent was, we found this before on a few occasions where they'll stuff well bentonite bags down the annular space and come back and top it off with bentonite to make it look like it's been sealed. Well, we got out there a little early and found this problem, so we worked with the well constructor to get it right. We also have a continuing education program that was authorized by the legislature, I believe it was last session, and that requires educational credits for well constructors to renew their licenses. We have a board, three people from the industry as well as somebody from the department that sit on the board and figure out which courses are out there available or which ones can be defined and created for continuing education credits. This is just an example, some classroom work, and that happens to be our lead well inspector giving that class to some well constructors. We developed well standards with the constructor, well construction industry, by rule, and that develops the standards under which wells are to be constructed, and then that's how we inspect those wells against those standards. As I mentioned, we license well constructors statewide. There are about 750 or so licensed well constructors in Oregon. I listed public safety because besides conservation of the resource in the design and construction of wells, it's also a public safety issue, as Tom Paul mentioned, prevention of contaminants getting into the groundwater aquifer and ruining the aquifer. And we provide public assistance. We got an awful lot of calls from well owners, people that want to drill wells, from realtors, developers that want to know if there's a well on the property. We put out a quarterly a newsletter called Well Said, primarily for the constructor industry, that talks about various issues, parts of our standards that maybe issues have come up, and we redefine them, try to put them into simple words so that folks can get an understanding of what they mean, and also we publish pictures like this in them every quarter so that folks out there, without zeroing in on any well constructor or anybody, we can get the word out that we're out inspecting, we're finding these things, and it's something that they ought to be thinking about. We also have a program area which we call groundwater hydrology. That's 8 groundwater hydrologists are in that section. They review all new applications for groundwater permits. They review those to figure out if there's water available in the ground to be appropriated. They look at water supply issues, whether the groundwater is overappropriated, it's at its limit of appropriation, or if there's additional water there to provide the new application, the person making the application. Of course, that's done to preserve the resource on a long-term basis, so it's sustainable for all the existing users, and that protects senior users. We look at issues like well interference between well users. As you can see, this depicts 3 different wells, and that's called a cone of depression. And of course, as the groundwater level drops, the cone of depression will expand and starts to interfere with an adjacent well, perhaps. And so this is an issue where we might get a call and people will say, my groundwater, I'm not getting the groundwater that I'm normally accustomed to. My neighbor's taking it. We've got to go out and take a look at the aquifer, use the information that we have available, and figure out if it's just simply an interference issue and the users need to deepen their wells to take full advantage of the aquifer, or in fact, perhaps the aquifer is over-appropriated, we're drawing down levels faster than it can recharge, in which case it may be a regulation issue, and we need to take a look at that in the future as far as new applications are concerned. Another example of interference could be a well located in a location that interferes with surface water, and you could be drawing from surface water as you use the groundwater, which in that situation could be taking surface water against away from a senior user. So that's one of the things that our groundwater folks look at in new applications, and it's also one of the things that we assess when we get complaints or we see that there's less surface water perhaps than you'd normally see in a year, and there's a new well in the area. And so we may have to regulate that groundwater user along with the surface water users according to data priority.
Madam Chair, one area that we've really seen a lot of activity here from our staff is Klamath Falls, because there's been so much movement to groundwater use to take the pressure off the lake that we've found some interference issues in the last several years where folks that have had long-time stable sources of groundwater have noted reductions in their water levels of fairly significant amounts. So our staff in this last year have been working closely with the folks at the Bureau of Reclamation who are contracting with people to provide groundwater to move away from wells that are interfering with their neighbors in a significant manner. It's been, I think, a very useful.
So are you actually mapping the underground geology based on well logs and things to try to link pieces of this together?
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. We've completed a basin-wide groundwater study in the Deschutes where we use the well logs. We go out and install recorders on wells. We actually partner with USGS and also Department of Geology, Yogami, to do some mapping of the geology for us, the hard rock, the geology of the area, we try to put all that information and figure out as best we can what the groundwater system looks like. We've completed in the Deschutes a basin-wide study. We're just about complete in the Willamette for the alluvial aquifer north of Salem to the north. We've got about 2 years away in the Klamath, and that's a full basin-wide study of the groundwater. We're trying to get one started in the Umatilla Basin. And then we've got a whole series of smaller studies that we've done or that are underway around the state, over on the coast. Here's one that we just completed not too long ago. It's an area near Bonanza down in the Klamath Basin that we did. It was just a small area where some applications for groundwater use stimulated a discussion over whether water was available. So we went in. It took us about 3 years. We completed a study there where we, as you say, mapped the geology and figured out the extent of the resource.
I'm just curious about how accurate they can be, being as you're kind of working at a lot of inference and you know, it's kind of feeling your way around a dark room with gloves on or something, that it must be a lot of assumptions built into a model of something that you can't really see.
Madam Chair, that was a pretty good analogy, feeling around a dark room with your gloves on. But it's amazing, really, when we're done, how accurate these studies are. And that's the reason for that is that we don't dry lab or mathematical model without data. We're real concerned about that, and we take a lot of extra time in getting a lot of data in the field, looking at the well logs, as we said, seeing what kind of geology exists in the area, getting ground water level measurements, even pump testing if we need to, defining the recharge areas, defining the amount of water use, going in and looking at all the water rights and trying to figure out how much they use and how much is recharged to the system and how much is actually consumed. So it takes a long time. The Deschutes took about 6 or 7 years. Klamath is about the same. The quality is assured through real data, not assumptions or just a mathematical model. So we can be pretty accurate.
So once you've done the study, does the study hold true over time, or is it something that changes over time?
Madam Chair, it changes over time as consumptive use changes over time, and as climate changes. If the climate is simply a cyclic, like hydrologists wish it were, then we can get a representation from a representative period and figure out what the recharge should be or has been over the period of time that you choose, a 30-year period of time, for instance, that represents wet cycles and dry cycles. But if indeed we are in a warming trend and a moving into a more dry cycle, then that would cause a change in the recharge as well for groundwater. We just do the best we can with the data that we can gather, and then if it does change, why we'll incorporate those at a later time.
But the connectivity issues, you know, the impact that one well has on the wells around it, that would stay the same over time, barring an earthquake or something like that that would change the way things were organized down under their ground.
Chair, I think that's correct, barring like an earthquake or something major. As groundwater levels drop, of course, and head drops, why you get some changes in conductivity, maybe things like that. But for the most part, it's pretty consistent. Long-term trend would be the same.
And if it's probably important to note here, and you'll see it in the POP associated with this division, but the governor's budget does remove the last general fund pot of money. At one time there was about $600,000 a biennium for us as an agency to participate in cooperative groundwater studies. They were often the state's contribution to a joint federal state effort with the USGS. That money is now eliminated. The last $200,000 goes away in this budget. And as we talked about last week, when times are better, that's something no doubt we'll be back asking for restoration of.
We also have, Madam Chair, we also have a program section that we call information technology. We've talked about that quite a bit previously to you. These are some examples of the types of information that's available and you can look at through our website, 350,000 scanned well logs. And I'll just point out that we are right now in an upward trend, but we're averaging about 600,000 hits on that database a year. We have 650,000 scanned documents, everything from water rights certificates, permits, final orders, and so on, that people can get on the web and see the original document. We have about 120,000 water right records. We are right now averaging about 275,000 hits per year on our water right records. We have an interactive mapping page where you can create your own map. You can overlay data on a aerial photos or a USGS topographical map if you want to, a generalized map of Oregon. You can overlay that with gauging stations if you want to see where they are. You can overlay them with points of diversion, wells. You can take a look at water availability and overlay that on the water rights. You can see where the water rights are located and how they're located adjacent to each other. Any way you'd like to design that map. You can do that. We're averaging right now about 450,000 hits per year on our interactive mapping site. We have just finished here in the last year an interactive flood event estimate where you can interactive model where you can pick a point on a reach in a stream, and it will define the basin above that point on the stream, pick the various basin parameters that are relevant to the flood flow estimate, and give you a peak flood estimate at that point on the stream. So you can get a 100-year storm, a 50-year storm, a 20-year storm, a 500-year storm, and you can see what the peak event would be at that location. And that's good for consultants. It might be good for homeowners that want to know how high that flood event might occur in a creek that's running alongside the house. Good for developers, good for local government. It's good for a lot of different interests. We did that with some money that was available through our dam safety program, as well as some money that the county, local association of Oregon counties participated, and also ODOT was interested in getting that information. We also, of course, I mentioned our interactive water availability estimates. You can get on site and look at what the 50% exceedance or the 80% exceedance natural flow is on our water availability basins around the state, and see what the consumptive use is as well above that point. We have over 40,000 years of average daily stream flow information. So for every year we have 365 average daily flows, we have over 40,000 years of that record. That's really important to hydrologists around the state that are helping developers. It's important for local government, again, realtors. A lot of people use that data. And we have 45,000 yearly peak stream flow estimates. We have gauges out there that measure what the peak is for the year and the high flow. Our dam safety program. We review plans and specifications for any dam in Oregon that's in excess of 9.2 acre feet of storage and 10 feet in height. And so if somebody wants to repair a dam, raise a dam, or build a new dam that exceeds those limits, they're required to hire a consultant, their own private consultant, prepare a set of plans and specifications, and then submit them to the Water Resources Department, who goes through those plans, works with a consultant, and approves those for construction. We also make a point of looking at new construction as much as we can, because if we can get the thing built right in the first place, then we have fewer problems down the road. So that's a high priority with us, is to look at all new construction. Would you like me to go ahead and go through some of those questions you asked previously, or?
Let's go ahead.
Go ahead with the presentation. Very good. We also require of all high hazard and a lot of the intermediate hazards, the hazards 1s and 2 that Tom Paul mentioned, that they put together an emergency action plan. And that includes a lot of things like calling lists, the types of monitoring that's to be done, the types of repair and maintenance that are to be done. It's all spelled out. We also require a dam break analysis so that we can tell, in the event that dam did fail catastrophically, what would happen downstream. And this is an example of an inundation map that was prepared for a dam break on a dam just up below. It's a high hazard that's just below Oregon City. The dam would be located here. And when you get one done with your dam break analysis, you can see this is a topographic map, so there are lines of elevation all over that map. And you can see the height that the flood wave would get as it moves downstream by looking at the topography lines, and then you can also see how long it takes for that peak flood wave and how long it takes to get to these different locations. So when we put together a call list, we know who's going to be notified, obviously anybody within the limits of that flood, and we know how long we've got to call them. So that's real good information, and then, of course, the call lists, we require that those are updated on an annual basis.
So how long would it take if the dam broke for it to get down to the bottom marker?
Well, it says time in hours is 1.88 hours to get that far, and that's about maybe 2.5 miles.
You have to hustle to get out of the way.
You do. This, of course, is one that we required on a privately owned dam. CORE has them for all the CORE reservoirs here in the Willamette. It's just standard practice for high hazard dams.
Representative Krieger.
Last year, Phil, I went down, just happened to be driving in Idaho, came across that Teton Dam. I drove in and saw how that had gone out, and they had a video that you could see in town about how that broke, and they got it on the air. Police knew about it, and still a terrible amount of devastation, and they didn't rebuild it. It's amazing. If you go down and look at that thing, what's left of it there, so the water went around the side, and the effect that it had, well, the speed that it got to where it was far greater than that.
Hmm.
Probably in an hour, most of it had pretty well done the trick.
One other thing, Madam Chair, if I might, I had a conversation with you earlier about the difference between wells and then a hand-dug well using surface water like a spring for the purpose of a domestic water supply. And you indicated at that time that that wasn't as big of a problem, as I understand, as trying to dig a well. The reason I'm wondering is because I can remember I talked about it earlier, couple of years. In fact, the first time I talked about it was before I came in the legislature. And the issue there was that if you were on a stream that had endangered species, this would have been Euchre Creek down near Gold Beach, this is a little tributary, that would be more difficult to get a permit to construct that type of a out of a spring that eventually goes to a creek and the creek to a bigger creek on down the line. Is that still something that your agency has to look at on every one of those surface water type springs that's going to be developed into a well?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, if the spring runs off the property, then it's subject to the requirement for a water right just like any other service right. So it would be a question of going through a public interest review as well as water availability. If there's water available and somebody can typically get a water right for that, but you wouldn't look at it any differently than you would any other surface right. If it does not run off the property, then...
Well, eventually I guess I'll have to come to you and get some expertise on what I got to do.
Dear Representative, it may have been, if I recall the conversation, I think we were talking about the fact that wells for domestic use are exempt from a requirement for getting a permit up front, and a spring development of this nature, if it has a connection to a live waterway, may well be subject to a closer look. Madam Chair, you had asked a couple questions of Barry. One that I was particularly interested in was the frequency that we found some failure problems or violation problems on wells, and the other that the federal overlap question. Could we go ahead and answer those for the record?
We can do those. That's a good idea.
Madam Chair, first the overlap. We communicate closely with the dam safety people at the Bureau of Reclamation and also the Corps of Engineers as well as U.S. Forestry and other federal agencies. We don't overlap on any of those programs, but we do talk to each other. And we're invited along on their inspections, and sometimes we go on their inspections with them, and sometimes we don't. It's just a good type of situation to have with other engineers and dam safety people, because we can learn a lot from them, and they occasionally learn something from us.
And how would it be divided between federal and state inspectors? How do you... They do federally licensed dams, and you do state licensed dams. Is that the only delineation? It hasn't to do with size or the capacity or anything like that?
Okay, that's correct. It doesn't have anything to do with size or capacity. The Corps looks at the dams they own and operate. The Bureau of Reclamation is a little fuzzier. They have jurisdiction in that they typically are in a contract situation with the irrigation districts. And so, but they do have a regular dam safety program. It's just not as clear about the ownership, although they do have some responsibility to see if they're maintained, and they'll cost share on rehabilitation and repair. They have a dam safety program. And as I said, they'll give us a schedule of their inspections and invite us to come along. And sometimes we go and sometimes we don't. But the state privately owned, local government owned, state owned, there are just a few. The Bureau, the Corps, the other federal agencies typically don't get involved. The private dams that are owned by public utilities that are FERC licensed, of course, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has a responsibility and a strong dam safety program to review those, and they require the owners to hire consultants and provide them detailed inspection reports on a periodic basis. We're invited to go along with them too. We have a good working relationship with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's office in Portland, and we participate in some of those, and sometimes they provide us, usually they'll provide us copies of those reports too. They will on asking, but a lot of times we'll just get them in the mail. So that's how the relationship is. Not really an overlap, but more of a working relationship with them. Another one of the questions that you asked, I think, is, some statistics. I don't have solid statistics with me today, but I can tell you that we typically have 10 to 20 projects under new construction each year. About half of those, maybe a little more, are new dams, and the others would be repairs. We might have a few more than 20 in some years of repairs where we've gone in and actually required some type of a major repair on a dam, like they're doing down at Fern Ridge, for instance. We'll write letters with just about every inspection we do. First of all, we get access from the owners, and we thank them for the access. And then we have a short discussion with them about what we found at the dam. If we didn't find anything, we'll tell them that. But typically we find things. We'll ask them to continue to keep brush and high weeds off the embankment because it provides cover for burrowing animals. You can't see if problems develop, those kinds of things. So we like that ground cover down pretty low. We like trees off the embankment because the roots can cause damage to the engineered embankment. They can cause a path of percolation for the water to move through the dam, and they can disrupt the integrity of the dam just by roots growing and making it looser material. So we write letters on all the dams. And as Tom mentioned, a lot of times we'll have spillways where debris or somebody's parked their boat or they filled it in because they want a higher water level or other things. Typically we find burrowing animal problems, we'll find filled in spillways, things like that, brush and debris. Sometimes we'll find new springs that have developed, water that's moving through the dam. Every dam leaks. They're designed to leak. The designer has to figure out how to control that leak, how to take care of the water as it moves through the structure. And that's exactly what the situation is in Fern Ridge. It was designed to leak. It has a drain in it. The problem is the drain plugged. And so then it didn't drain properly, and the water boiled up and came through the embankment. So that's why they're fixing that dam.
So how do you clean a drain in a dam?
Well, if you have a good enough set of plans, you know where the outfall is. If it's built the way we like them built, the drains are zoned, so they have different outfalls for different areas of the dam, so you aren't just kind of wondering where to go. And you can camera it if it's a large enough pipe. You can roto-root it just like you would a sewer line, or you dig it up and replace it. And if you have a good set of plans, a good set of design drawings, you know where it was located and you know what it was constructed from, and so then you have a reasonable chance of getting it fixed.
Madam Chair, for the record, I had the opportunity to inspect a dam last summer that Mr. Norris had designed many years ago when he was in the private sector, and the dam, it was still working, Madam Chair.
I'm glad to hear that.
Some of the highlights of our program for the Technical Services Division over the last couple of years is that, as I mentioned, we've completed the Deschutes Basin. We're just about complete with the Willamette Basin and another couple of years on the Klamath Basin for groundwater investigations. Those are a major boost to our groundwater program because, as we discussed, they give us a lot of knowledge, a lot of understanding on the groundwater. And so it just is a benefit for managing the resource. It's a benefit for everybody using the resource. We have a partnership with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation in providing technical assistance on management of groundwater in the water bank programs down the Klamath Basin. As you know, they've turned to groundwater because they're a little bit short of surface water down there, denying surface water to some people. That's created a lot of stress on the system, a lot of interference between well users, and so we're helping them manage the situation to mitigate the problems and avoid problems. We've implemented a very successful well-constructed continuing education program. We've moved our hydrographics program processing from an outdated piece of software called Western Hydro to a brand new piece of software that it's the difference between horse and buggies and modern automobiles. It's going to increase our efficiency, increase the quality of the product, and enable our hydrographers to work a lot more data in less time. And that's an example of how we're dealing with new technology, how we're using two new technology to deal with an increasing workload. We've completion of an online interface to the flood frequency analysis anywhere in the state. I mentioned told you about that just a minute ago. We sponsored a dam safety workshop for dam owners and consultants. We do that every 2 years. We've been doing it since about the mid-'80s. It's been very successful. People call us up and ask us when we're going to have another one. We typically get between 200 and 250 people to come, where we put on a workshop with case histories of dam construction, what goes into designing for earthquake, just various issues like that involving designing hydraulic structures. Very successful program. We successfully negotiated a process providing technical assistance and review of a high-hazard dam construction, design and construction, to a Native American tribe here in Oregon. We all know about sovereign rights and issues that can develop between the state and tribes about that issue, and so we worked with them very closely. They wound up with a better product, and we wound up with them in compliance and a product that we feel very secure about.
This is your district, Madam Chair.
I was just going to say, would that be in my neck of the woods?
What dam was that? Or was it?
It's one that's being constructed by the Cow Creeks up in the draws behind the casino in Canyonville.
Oh, Madam Chair, we toured that. Is that? Are they filling that yet, or is that completed?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, I don't believe they're not filling it yet, but it's still got some construction.
I was amazed what they were allowed to do, where they were allowed to do it.
Well, that's one of the reasons we were concerned about the hazard rating on it, right above the freeway, above the trailer park, and so on. And so we wanted to feel good about it. And so we worked real closely with them and got ourselves involved. And
I need to go back. I need to go back and look at it again.
Definitely an issue of interest with us, and we went through some pretty intensive negotiations with the tribe and reached a real solid level of cooperation. So we're feeling much better about the situation.
Our policy option packages, the 090 is a reduction in the governor's budget that reduces our division 2 FTE. One is a programmer in the information technology section that was concerned with transfers and scanning of documents, making that a more streamlined process. That's going to have the effect of slowing us down a little bit on developing our technology. And the other position is a water use reporting engineering position that deals with the public entities that report water use, as well as the various users out, permit holders, permit and certificate holders. So that's going to slow us down on keeping track of water use out in the field. Incidentally, I want to point out to you that on page 75 of your booklet, that lists those as other fund positions, and those are not. They are general fund positions. And then the 142, it continues a long-standing limited duration position that is tasked with entering all of our well log data and start card data into the database. That's been a limited duration position in the budget for probably 20 years. And on page
Is any part of that log database a computer process from the beginning of the process, or does it still all start with paper?
Excellent question, Madam Chair. There's a limited process now that the constructors can submit their start cards on over the web. We're in the process now of designing and putting together a process where the well logs and start cards and everything can be computerized. One of the problems was funding for the types of software that we needed and so forth, getting it a high enough priority among all the other things we're doing. And another obstacle has been there are just a handful of well constructors that are comfortable using a computer. And so, but we think if we get the right software out there online that's very simple and pretty straightforward, we can convince more of them to do that. So hopefully next session we'll be able to report some solid progress back to you.
Well, it would be interesting, too, to see how much you can save in terms of personnel time on having it just be an electronic process all the way through. And if there's a potential to give those folks a break in their filing fees or something to kind of move them in that direction.
Madam Chair, we're interested in that, and we're also interested in the more people we can keep out of the process, the fewer chances we have to be in there. Mm-hmm. And I was just going to say that last one is listed on page 76 of your book as a permanent position. It's always been overcome at Start Card B.
So, Madam Chairman, that concludes Mr. Norris's presentation. If there are no other,
I have one thing, and I don't know where this actually fits into the grand scheme of things, but you have a program related to the Scenic Waterways Program. Where is that in the grand scheme of things?
Scenic Waterways?
Madam Chair, that's primarily Mr. Paul's shop, so I'd be delighted to bring him forward
to
answer any questions
and,
you might have there.
I have no... First of all, I need to know what the program is, and secondly, I'm interested in the funding streams.
Madam Chair, we do quite a, and Mr. Paul can jump in and correct me or supplement me here as need be. We do quite a bit of work related to scenic waterway activities. We have to review potential water rights as to whether they will have an impact on scenic waterways. Quite a number of things like that. Additional activities, Tom?
Madam Chair, in addition to our water right review and our water availability information that Barry Norris monitors in his shop, when our field folks are out in the field, they're looking, well, they know where the scenic waterways are, and they're looking for construction activity that's occurring, and they will report that to parks if they see that.
So does the program primarily reside in the Parks Department?
The Scenic Waterway, a lot of it is parks. We're involved because of the water aspects of that. A lot of the scenic waterways have flow requirements, and that's what we're interested in, is maintaining those flows consistent with the scenic values, and that's Dwight's shop in water rights. They're reviewing new water right applications to see what the impact of new withdrawals would be from within the scenic waterway.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, in the Deschutes Basin, where the groundwater study has shown a very direct connection between the groundwater and the surface water, then we have to evaluate new groundwater applications for their impact on the scenic waterway. So there is a fair amount of work along that line, and indeed the committee did ask us to take a look at this issue last session, and we did enter into an agreement with Parks where they provided a small amount of funding. I believe it was $100,000 ended up being the level of the agreement to cover some of the work that we have done. I think our analysis of the actual agency-wide cost of the work we do relative to the Scenic Waterway Program was over $200,000 a year, maybe closer to $250,000. I have those. I have that information back at my office, and I can resurrect that. But that is, we did, at the committee's direction, enter into some discussions with the Parks Department, and we felt like we could very, very safely tie at least $100,000 of work directly into that Scenic Waterway program, and so we reached that agreement with Parks this last
financial year. If you would be so kind to convey the information on the total cost to Mr. Siebert, I would much appreciate that.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, let's move ahead here. I'm hoping that in the next half hour we can conclude this.
We have just a couple things yet to do, Madam Chair, so I'd ask Mr. Allman to come forward and talk a little bit quickly about his shop, and then I'll have a few concluding thoughts, and we'll be done.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Mike Allman, Administrator for the Administrative Services Division. The division consists of 10.5 FTE. Fiscal Services, this is the group responsible for accounting, payroll benefits, purchasing, facilities coordination, and contracting. Human Services, responsible for recruitment, labor relations, position classification, affirmative action, diversity. The Business Services section, this is where the budget preparation and execution takes place, as well as agency-wide services such as reception, mail, things like that. Finally, the loan program is housed within this division. We've talked a little bit about that in our hearings. It is authorized in the Constitution. The program's not competitive any longer. However, we are still servicing loans after the year 2017.
Madam Chair. Why is it not? Thank you, Madam Chair. Why is it not competitive?
Interest rates are not competitive with other loans that the constituents can get.
Revolving loan account cheaper than you can borrow money from the government.
That's hard to believe, but possible, I suppose. Why are your loan rates higher?
I believe it's in the Constitution.
Okay. Want to try to change that?
That shouldn't be much of a job.
Please proceed.
I wanted to touch on the division's efficiencies. I want to highlight for you the SPOTS card program. SPOTS stands for the Small Purchase Order Transaction System. It's a Visa card system. We found that it's very convenient and efficient for not only our staff members, but also for vendors that are receiving payment. We've been able to increase the number of vendors paid. We're expecting over 200 vendors in fiscal year 04. What that translates into for us is less purchase orders and less check writing. You also see a huge dollar volume of payments that have continued to be made through this program. Of course, we have controls in place. We have very strict documentation standards. We audit all transactions going through the system, and we have continual training for all of our cardholders on an annual basis. I wanted to touch on the workload for the division, and I'm highlighting here the contracting workload. You'll notice that the dark bars on the graph indicate the regular type of contracting that the division has seen historically. This is for a lot of the just the contracted services, other funds type of contracting. We are contracting for the whole department. You'll see, though, that the lighter bars is what I wanted to focus on, and that is the Receipts Authority Program and what that's done to our contracting level. Contracts are created with not only the constituent, but also the vendor providing the services. And so we've seen a dramatic rise in the amount of contracting efforts that we've had to do. Of course, House Bill 2186 would remove the sunset clause on the Receipts Authority Program, and we expect this trend to continue. I finally wanted to touch on some highlights for the division. In September of 2003, we relocated to the North Mall office building. The division coordinated that move. We received the Gold Star Award for Excellence in Financial Reporting since the inception of that program some 20 plus years ago. We have enhanced our management evaluation tools for performance and competencies, obviously in the areas of affirmative action, planning, communication, and all aspects of leadership. And then we talked about the SPOTS card program. But I'll just quickly recap. That's very convenient and efficient for our staff. It's faster payment to the vendors, better customer service, and, of course, less processing for my staff. Finally, I'll touch on the policy option packages in the budget. The governor's budget reduced in Prop 90 one-half FTE for the reception duties. This was the last remaining FTE on general fund responsible for those duties. And of course, that person answered phones, greeted walking customers. It also eliminated $275,000 in general fund debt service for the loan program. And again, we think that that program is solvent now and does not need that general fund cash infusion. Finally, policy option package 111 provides for one-half FTE to manage that reimbursement authority contracting process that we saw. I would remind you that House Bill 2186 would remove the sunset on that. And in POP 11 was also some limitations for the pass-through fees collected from constituents to pass on to the vendors providing the services.
Questions, comments? Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a few things from me to conclude our presentation with your permission.
Please proceed.
Just a few things about the Director's Office. You can see how we're laid out financially. The Commission obviously is a part of the Director's Office package, and our rule development work, again, as we discussed earlier in this process, the Commission is the rulemaking body for this agency, and so we have extensive work involved in rule development through the Commission. Policy legal coordination, nearly $500,000 of this budget is the legal, the general legal bill for the agency. And so a fairly significant amount of money there, and that's assigned in the Director's Office. Again, we do citizen response, public information, and the bottom piece I'd note there, the intergovernmental coordination piece, you can interpret that more closely for this agency as tribal. And as we talked about earlier, there we have very extensive interactions with the tribes in this state relative to different water-related activities. The dam that the Cow Creeks were putting in place was one example. So we definitely are very closely connected with the tribes. Okay. So for this Director's Office, one of the things that we're trying to do is really drive a culture of customer-friendly regulatory streamlining government in this agency. And that sounds like a bunch of platitudes, but we've actually tried to do some things, Madam Chair, that to actually indicate our sincerity in that regard.
Now he's got me interested.
You woke Representative Krieger up.
Yeah, you did. Hey.
Well, Representative, I'm proud to announce that we actually, this past year, eliminated three divisions of administrative rules in the Oregon Water Resources Department's portfolio. These were antiquated, to put it politely, rules that had been on the books for years, which simply cluttered up Oregon water law, and so we eliminated those.
So how old were these rules?
A number of them, Madam Chair, preceded both you and I think, in birth, but it was
weren't that old then.
They were very, yeah, they
were
recent. Middle-aged rules.
Very recent, Madam Chair.
Dr. Bates.
Our legislative package.
Wait a minute.
Representative Creek.
You're talking about doing away with administrative rule, but remember your expedited permit to construct a small pond or reservoir? And I jumped up and down because when I got it, it was 6 pages and a 7-page book on how to fill out the 6 pages. And I told Martha Padgett at the time, this is not faster, slower, faster, quicker, shorter, simpler. I look at what you really need. I can put it on one page if you don't make me say it 5 times. Well, 3 times I had to put my name in, 4 times I had to put the size of the pipe. I mean, it just goes on and on. You need to look at that. If you can't do it, I'll do it for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative,
it's your fault. You weren't there.
Well,
I would certainly acknowledge one of the things that I know is the water business is a very litigious business, and as a result, it is very clearly articulated throughout law and rule. And sometimes I think we would admit we've gone overboard as an agency to make sure we did things in a legally defensible manner. So what have we done about that? Actually, we took the governor's admonishment to look at regulatory streamlining very seriously. We completed 10 projects in the agency this past year whereby we took processes like that and simplified them. 5 out of our 6 pieces of legislation that were introduced on our behalf this year were actually regulatory streamlining pieces. One example is relates to reservoirs. You need a permit both to store water in a reservoir, and then you need to go get another permit to use it. And it struck us as something that this second permit ought to be a simplified process, and we have legislation in place to do that this session, which is working its way through the process. We really are trying to be sincere about that effort. We did several other things. You can see here. One I'd notice the note I'd highlight for you, the notice and concurrence work group. You remember the water ownership issue that was such a challenging issue last session. We held a work group in the interim that actually dealt with a number of the issues that arose out of that particular debate and made a little progress. We're certainly not where we'd like to be over the long term, but we did make some progress. So, policy option packages for this agency. POP 090 is the reduction package, and it does eliminate one FTE, and that is the individual that does our full-time intergovernmental work, the tribal work that we talked about earlier. Again, right now we currently have projects underway with the Klamath tribes, the Umatilla tribes, the Coos, the Coquille. I had a list here and it's gotten away from me. So that will be a workload issue for us, both in terms of expertise and dividing this work up to another party, to other parties. So, Madam Chair, I think this is a section that we talked about in phase one, so we can stop here. I'd be happy to answer any further questions for you, or we're here at your pleasure for the rest of the day, Madam Chair.
Representative Krupp indicated that he did have some questions that he wanted to ask on the dam safety issue.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that opportunity. I had to testify on a bill that Senator Bates and I co-sponsored to deal with an issue that has to do with the invasive aquatic weeds and how to deal with that.
Please bear in mind, Representative Krupp, that this is the Budget Committee.
Yes, I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair. I always appreciate being reminded of where I am.
Nothing else is important as budget, I understand. I was talking to May about Med-Mail, so I'm sorry.
Several friends of mine irrigate out of the Long Tom, and the process, as I understand it, is the Fern Ridge Dam obviously is mostly earthen dam and had some leakage issues to it. It necessitated, in essence, draining the dam down to a level where they can make that repair. What kind of impact on the farmers who irrigate out of that are you able to manage on their behalf? What plan have you put together to help them?
Sounds like I beg your pardon, but I think that's a little out of the dam safety issue and more in the field operations division. And with your permission, I'm going to ask the buck to...
Absolutely.
Well, before you go, Madam Chair, if I may, what's the time frame to repair the dam, and do you think that they will be within that window that they said they could achieve the repair work?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, as I understand their time frame, they were talking about doing most of the repairs this summer, course, working as long as they can into the fall before it gets so they can't work in the because of the rains, and then finishing off the work next year. That should be doable, in my opinion, with this type of construction. It's just a matter of pretty straightforward. It's a matter of getting in there, creating the haul roads, and taking the earth embankment down. They should be able to repair those drain lines pretty quickly, replace them. They did an adequate job before they clogged, so that probably isn't much to the design, and then they'll raise them back up. So it's a long dam and a lot of earth, but they should be able to stay within their time frame.
Madam Chair, a quick follow-up. What are they doing to mitigate this problem occurring again? Are they changing the design, modifying it? What are they doing?
Madam Chair, Sam Crop, there's been a lot of technology development in the last 15 or 20 years about drain design. And there's been a lot of discussions among designers, and there was some experimentation done for a while with what they called filter fabrics, comparing those with regular manufactured aggregate drains. And I think that problem's pretty well solved. They can use if they pay attention to the recent design standards that have been looked at again with all the various federal agencies and state agencies and consultants, should be a fairly long-lasting product, keeping in mind that these types of structures are typically designed for about a 50-year life cycle.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. And if I can ask at your discretion, Madam Chair, Tom, to come up and just share with me briefly what the plan is to mitigate the problems for the farmers.
For the record, Tom Paul, Madam Chair, Representative, our region manager and water master have each attended several meetings with the local farmers, working with them, providing information to them. We've also met with the Corps, and we're working with the Corps. I think recently they announced they were going to increase the amount of water that was going to be held in Fern Ridge, and that water will be available, I believe, to satisfy some of the irrigation contracts. We're also working with Lane County to try to secure an assistant water master for the summertime down there, again, so that we can assure that the holders of the senior water rights get the water that they're entitled to.
Madam Chair, Representative, there will be folks, though, that do not receive the water that they customarily do. So,
I know. I have relatives and friends who irrigate out of that system, and that's what they've been told. And just whatever, Madam Chair, for the record, whatever your department can do to mitigate that to the greatest extent possible, I'd be greatly appreciated.
Thank you. Ms. Pearson, would you like any last words or comments?
That's okay. Great. Last will and testament.
Mr. Siebert, do you have any additional information for us?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to notify you, there were a number of people that expressed interest in testifying on the department's budget. They are all in another water hearing. And I believe that they asked for the opportunity to carry over this bill to tomorrow, first thing, just for public testimony.
And I have agreed to do that. So what we'll do is carry over the public hearing on House Bill 5073, and we'll open tomorrow's meeting with public testimony on that bill. And then when we finish the public testimony, the balance of tomorrow will be on completing the DLCD budget hearing. So with that, I will adjourn this committee.
Thank you.